Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On this week's show, we're going to be cracking open a new collection of short stories by a Pulitzer Prize winner and returning to a favourite non-fiction work going behind the scenes at a cow farm. We'll also discuss two new plays currently on in London's West End. To guide us through these topics, I'm joined in the studio by two Monocle 24 regulars, John Mitchinson, co-founder and chief publishing officer of Unbound Books, and Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times. Before the end of the show, we'll also hear from the director of a new stage version of the classic horror film The Exorcist, and Fernando will be here for our weekly Global Countdown. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. John and Matt, welcome to the show. Let's start with you, Matt. Your first play today is political comedy Labour of Love, written by James Graham and directed by Jeremy Herrin. It tells the story of a Labour MP kind of obsessed with modernising his party, but whose constituency is right up there in the traditional north of the country. It's a play about the Labour Party and kind of well-documented divisions, I guess, that have become visible in recent years. What's the timescale, though? How far back do we go?
It covers about three decades, I think 27 years to be exact. And the structure of it is interesting because it goes backwards in the first act and then forwards in the second act. So it kind of is almost like a mirror poem. And in fact, there's an image throughout the evening of exactly the structure of the play. James Graham does slightly clobber you over the head with the idea that the characters are talking about the very device that his play is following. So the whole thing has a kind of meta quality to it. But I think what's interesting about it as a piece of theater is what it isn't as much as what it is. You can feel that James Graham thought, oh, I don't want this to be like a David Hare, very worthy, slightly hectoring, preaching to the converted kind of evening. So as a result, it's actually quite gag-filled. In fact, we're going to talk about Mel Brooks later, but there are bits in Labour of Love you thought, did Mel Brooks doctor the script? And there are all these kind of pop culture references, Yoda, Beetlejuice, Game of Thrones, Bikram Yoga, the Tamsin Gregg character, who's a constituency agent for the Labour MP played by Martin Freeman, is kind of a walking punchline. And it's very, very enjoyable. And you can sort of see the play really wanting to appeal to a broader public and not just the niche market that you might expect would already go to see a play like this.
And do you think it loses something in not having that kind of deeper message? You know, you're mentioning that it's not a David Hare that's a bit preachy.
No, because I kind of feel like we've seen that. I mean, David Hare wrote a play about a thinly veiled version of Neil Kinnock some years ago at the National called Absence of War. And in fact, it was just announced the other day at the National Theatre that David Hare has his own play about the contemporary state of the Labour Party coming to the National next year. So those sorts of plays, not just by David Hare, continue to be written. I think what's slightly deceptive about Labour of Love, although it's embedded in the title, is that it's a love story as much as anything else. And without giving too much away, there's a sort of slow blooming but maybe not a romantic component that is as important as the politics, but you don't quite realize how important until the very end. It's interesting, some years back, that Tamsin Gregg won an Olivier Award for playing Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing, the Shakespeare comedy. And there's quite a lot of Beatrice and Benedict, Shakespeare's archetypes, in these two characters who are sparring as a way of erecting their defenses. But actually, when the defenses are down, they feel like they could be moving towards one another. And in a way, it's as if politics is the framework that allows that to happen. So it acknowledges politics, but also moves beyond it.
I mean, you mentioned two of the characters there. I mean, the two main characters, Martin Freeman and Tamsin Gregg. They're two of the best-liked comedic actors of their generation, although mostly, I guess, known for their TV performances. What's their onstage chemistry like?
Well, Tamsin Gregg, who I absolutely love, she took over in this from Sarah Lancashire, who dropped out for reasons that haven't quite been determined. Tamsin Gregg does a lot of theater. I think this is the third theater thing I've seen her in the last 12 months. She was a female Malvolio at the National Malvolia, and then she was in a Tony Kushner play before that at the Hampstead. She's great. I mean, of course, she's wonderful on TV, but I always feel as if somehow theater is her natural habitat. For one thing, she's got a fantastic voice. She really does have a sort of innate theatrical presence and the vocal heft to go with it. Martin Freeman, I've seen on stage less. Of course, as you say, he's best known from TV Sherlock, but he's great as well, and he gets a very audience pleasing moment where he does a kind of breakout dance move. They have to have a kind of push-me-pull-you charm. That's what this play depends upon. And even though there are lots of other characters in it, including the actress Rachel Sterling, playing the least well-written part, which is Martin Freeman's sort of on-again, off-again wife, putative ex-wife, really. And you never really quite believe that they would have got together to begin with. But in a sense, you want to peel away all the rest of these people and just focus on Freeman and Gregg because they click so sensationally well.
And James Graham is obviously a huge young talent in British theatre. Have you seen some of his other work, and how does this compare to the likes of Ink?
Yeah, I think I've seen almost all of it. What's interesting about James is, I don't know, he's somewhere in his mid-30s, something like that, and he's written any number of plays about events that happened before he was born. And I mean, I guess you could say Shakespeare did that too, because Shakespeare wrote lots of history plays about things he didn't live through. But it's very interesting that, you know, James Graham has another play running minutes away from Labour of Love called Ink, which is set in the late 60s about the early days of Rupert Murdoch in the UK, of course, long before James Graham was on this earth. And I think it's kind of wonderful that James Graham is not writing, you know, we're always told in writing classes in theater, write what you know. Hmm. Well, James Graham is doing exactly the opposite of that. He's kind of taking flights of imaginative fancy. And I think that's terrific. I wish more playwrights did that.
And finally, obviously, we've got the Labour Party is the centre point of this play. Do you think it makes any point about the future of the Labour Party? I mean, we've obviously got a lot of the last 30 years here. Do we get a sense that these two sides of the party, Westminster and the North, are they reconcilable?
Well, it's a really good question. I took as my guest to this an American who doesn't, unlike myself, live in London, and he had no problem getting it, which is both maybe a strength and a defect. In other words, it does kind of play to the crowd, as it were. I also bumped into some stalwart Labour supporting friends of mine who thought that the play was a bit of a cop out. They wanted something much more hard hitting. So I suspect that might be a response that people are going to have. More politics, less banter. I think for what it is and where it is, it works quite well.
Labour of Love is showing at the Noel Coward Theatre until the 2nd of December. Matt, your second play is the West End version of celebrated Mel Brooks musical Young Frankenstein. It first opened on Broadway in 2007, but Brooks has shortened it a bit here and cockneyed it up, as he said, for the British audience.
Yeah. He's also introduced references to Noel Coward and Marks and Spencer.
Okay,
maybe those are spoilers. Well, anyway, you'll forget it by the time you see it. I saw this show on Broadway 10 years ago, and all I can say is what a difference an ocean makes, and also a smaller venue. In New York, it was playing one of Broadway's largest theaters, the then called Hilton, which is like a hotel equivalent of a theater. And the show itself was like the monster. It was like Frankenstein's monster. It was kind of this lumbering, quasi-inert thing that occasionally jolted to life. And here, it's been scaled back. It's been sharpened. It's been cast with lots of British comedians who know what they're doing. People like Leslie Joseph Ross Noble, who, unlike Tamsin Gregg and Martin Freeman, you perhaps don't necessarily associate with the theater, but they seem very at home in the theater. And the whole thing just works. I mean, it's not at all deep. If you want kind of substance to go with your song and dance, go see Follies at the National. This is all kind of end of pier tits and bum style humor. And a lot of it is, you know, you're kind of waiting for the brumcha and kind of the hook to drag whoever's said the most recent quip off stage. But that's always been Brooks's terrain. And, you know, very few people do it as well as he does. And the fact that he's still doing it is kind of amazing, because there he was last night on stage of the Garrick Theatre, sharing in the applause, and he's 91. How many of us are doing anything at age 91, much less soaking up the applause of a West End audience? I really do think that's quite incredible.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you said that, you know, it felt much better than the first time you saw it. I mean, this is still directed by Susan Stroman, isn't it, who's worked with Mel Brooks many times before, and she did the choreography and direction here. Why do you think it's changed so much in the 10 years?
You know, I've spent 30 years straddling the Atlantic, and it really is an endlessly fascinating, mystifying thing how some shows work on one side of the pond and don't work on the other, and there is no exact science to it. I suspect in this case, the lack of pressure had something to do with it. When it opened in New York, it was still more or less in the immediate wake of the musical version of The Producers, which had been this huge kind of unexpected musical behemoth, won every award going. You know, the ticket prices were then extortionate. Now they seem quite normal, but then they were, you know, $100 a ticket. Wow. And I think really it buckled under the weight of all that. And Mel Brooks was thinking bigger means better. And Stroman, or Stroa, she's called in the business, who really is a remarkable talent. She's worked at the Garrick Theatre before. She did a musical there a few years ago called The Scottsboro Boys. And so she understands kind of the smaller confines of that space. And you can kind of do it as an end of peer entertainment, but with fabulous production values and a really great cast that these days, I suspect, you'd be hard pressed to find at an actual end of peer.
Right. And you mentioned some of the cast members there. How did you find Ross Noble, who plays Igor, who's the hunchback henchman? We've got Summer Stralin, is that his name as well?
The Stralinist.
Kind of looks right, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's one of my. He's got his hump keeps moving around. And there's one triumphant moment where Hadley Fraser, who I must say is wonderful in the part of, you know, kind of the straight man of the piece who has to come into his family name by the end. He's much, much better than the guy who originated on Broadway a decade ago. But there's a great moment where he looks at Igor, or Igor, depending on how you pronounce his name, and says, oh, your hump is gone. This is a great triumph. And Ross Noble reveals that it hasn't gone. It's just moved to the middle. And Leslie Joseph, who plays the part, the Cloris Leachman played in the movie Frau Blücher, which then ignites whinnying from these two horses. She's got absolutely, I don't know if it's makeup or maybe it's just her physiognomy, but she does have this kind of demented gleam in her eyes, which is exactly what you want. Summer Stralin, as you say, playing Inga, who's like, if you know the producers, she's this show's equivalent to Ulla in the producers. There's always some kind of, you know, vaguely Scandinavian, Transylvanian seductress. And in this one, it's Summer Stralin. And she's got legs that just won't quit. Every single thing she says or does is some sort of double or triple entendre. I mean, sure, if you want to be politically correct about it, I guess you could say, oh, this is demeaning to women. But you know what? Mel Brooks is an equal opportunity offender. And it's actually shot through, I think, in this production with a lot of buoyancy and heart. And the ending of it is unexpectedly touching when the Hadley Fraser character does come into his own. And it's rather, sorry to keep invoking Shakespeare here, but it's rather like a Shakespearean comedy. Everyone gets coupled with the right person, or I should say the right monster.
Okay, interesting. Young Frankenstein is showing at the Garrick Theatre till the 10th of February next year. Thanks very much, Matt. Let's move on to books now. John, your first pick today is a re-release from 2003 by Rosamund Young, The Secret Life of Cows, a collection of anecdotes about rearing animals on a farm. I love the sound of this. Tell us a little bit about why you picked this.
Well, two reasons. One, it's utterly charming. The second is I have, you know, small holdings, so I've got pigs and sheep. I don't have cows.
Right.
But, you know, it's an irresistible title, right? The Secret Life of Cows. It comes, Faber obviously found this somewhere. It was published on a sort of small farming press in 2003. It's now being released with an Alan Bennett introduction. The premise is very, very simple. Rosamund Young, her family have been farming in Worcestershire since the 50s. And they have treated their farm animals as most of us would treat pets. They have given them names. They've loved them. They've formed relationships. They've watched them. They've taken the lead from the animals themselves. She says, just at the beginning of the book, she said, cows are as varied as people. They can be highly intelligent or slow to understand, friendly, considerate, aggressive, docile, inventive, dull, proud, or shy. And then really the book is a kind of an exploration of these wonderfully named cows. Straw Beret, Fat Hat, the Duke of York, Jane Eyre, Mr. Black Hat, Baby Jane, the Duke of Lancaster. These kind of dynasties of cows.
And you actually have a family tree.
There's a family tree right in the front of the book. And it's she writes really, really simply and beautifully. I kind of like my countryside books written by, rather like James Rebank, the shepherd. I like people who are farming. James Lewis Stemple as well, who's another one who wrote Meadowland, rather than tourists. I mean, if anybody keeps animals, this is it's a useful book. But if you don't, I think, as Alan Bennett says, you know, what it does is it restores a sort of sense of what's going on in the fields. When you look at a group of cows after this book, you'll realize that you're probably looking at a family group. They probably have kind of arguments. There are probably sort of favorites. It's a completely wonderful, simple idea of observing animals over a long period of time and then kind of recording it. I mean, I suspect that Faber have probably got a small hit on their hands here. And I mean, nothing would make me happier. I mean, the serious bit of the book, I suppose, is if you wanted to give anybody a kind of a manifesto for organic farming or for non-intensive farming, this book makes the case brilliantly. It's also inadvertently at times very, very funny. There's a great list at the back. I keep sheep, as I've said, and 20 things you ought to know about sheep. There is 20 things to about most of the farm animals, but I like number two is sheep can be highly intelligent, and then number three is sheep can be very dim. And between those two, let me tell you, most of sheep farming happens in between those two poles.
Right.
But it's a wonderful, lovely book.
And is part of the charm here that it actually wasn't initially written for a kind of mainstream audience? It was written quite specifically for, I guess, the farming community. You said it was a small imprint.
I guess that is part of it. It doesn't feel like it's had kind of, you know, the grubby sort of thumbprints of a publisher looking to make a quick buck all over it. It does feel very authentic, and it's got lovely, lovely little chapter headings. It's very easy to read. It's a short book. It runs to about 160 pages. It's, I think, in a way, well done for Faber for spotting it and putting it out. I have to say, I think they could have made it look a little bit more enticing, but that's the publisher in me talking. But it's fun.
And is there a deeper message behind the book, or does it end with a sort of an argument about intensive farming, or do you think it's kind of implied basically throughout the book because of the subject matter?
I think the deeper message is, I think it's much like raising children, you know, or dealing with human beings. If you listen and try and understand the motivations of the people that your family, your friends, that your work colleagues, you'll probably be more effective. The one thing I feel that the book doesn't have, which I would have loved to have explored a little bit more, is we know that not all these animals live to, you know, to see out their natural life. There must be the loading the animals and the taking them to the abattoir. She doesn't go into that at all. And I did feel like I was hoping and expecting that there might be a little bit, having gone to the trouble of creating these dynasties and giving the animals names. I know, you know, from experience, it's not easy waving them goodbye.
Absolutely, because that's the whole point, really. I mean, you mentioned that they treat them like pets, but of course they aren't pets.
They're not pets.
They are being used for something. And it's a shame that isn't kind of...
I hope. I mean, you know, I think maybe...
There's a sequel somewhere, isn't
it? Well, maybe it'll come out in some of the conversations. She sounds... Rosamund Young sounds like a woman who can handle herself well in interviews. So I hope that her and the extraordinary farm she runs gets great publicity out of it.
And some reviewers have said that this book should be given to people suffering with anxiety because it's so wonderfully calming. Did you find it had that effect on you? I mean, is it one of those books
No,
that
not
really...
at all. I felt I should be looking after my animals better. I found it quite anxiety inducing, I'm afraid, as a sort of smallholder. But I can see what people mean, and I think there's a part of me that slightly dislikes that armchair farming thing. People are vicariously sort of reading about it rather than doing it. But if you're going to have it, it's much better, as I say, to have it from somebody who's a practitioner rather than, as it were, somebody who is just sort of spending a weekend in the country and writing sort of passionately about sunsets and the smell of the corn. This is some of the things in the book that getting up during the night to feed calves, to save calves, to the kind of some of the heartbreak in the book, I find it's moving. It's in its own way a small, perfectly formed masterpiece, I think.
The Secret Life of Cows is out now, published by Faber and Faber. John, your second pick today is Fresh Complaint, the first ever published collection of short stories from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geoffrey Eugenides. However, although the collection is new, the stories date back to 1988, so some predate his first novel even. John, what connects these 10 short stories? Or could you divide them up, I guess, into multiple categories?
I think there is a general sense the complaint of the title is a sort of slight howl at the loss of innocence of the world. A lot of the protagonists in the stories are men in their middle way who are failing to deal one way or another with the failure of their ambition or the failure of their relationships. I mean, to that extent, it's not what you would call a groundbreaking collection of stories. I mean, we've probably all read novels, you know, the whole works of John Updike and much of, you know, traditional male white American literature there for us to read. But Eugenides is good. This is the thing. It's sort of, you want to be less generous. But you feel that he's enjoying writing these stories. You feel that he's enjoying putting his protagonist through these sort of trials. There's two of my favourite stories, in fact, have got women as the main protagonists. The opening story, which is about the friendship between a younger woman and an older woman, and they bond over books. That's really touching and beautifully done. And the final story, where he kind of... he sets up a kind of a physicist, an English lecturer in physics who's based in America, who ends up having a fateful one-night stand with a young Indian girl. It turns out she's set him up and she reports him for assault and rape. It's dark, but he manages to do it with a kind of a delicacy. He's the thing that I guess Eugenides' prose is, or Eugenides, or however we pronounce his name, it's the wit. He manages to keep you going through the stories. There are some amazingly, brilliantly precise passages of writing in the book, and some very, very funny ones. There's a great story called Baster about a middle-aged woman who runs a party to collect sperm from men she wants to be impregnated by, which sounds like it could be chauvinistic and unpleasant. It was turned into a not very good movie called The Switch. But actually, the story itself is great. And I mean, I'll just give you a bit of why I think Eugenides is fun. He said, men... She's asked all the men to stick their tongues out. And he says the men had obliged, asking no questions. Men always oblige. Men like being objectified. They thought that their tongues were being inspected for nimbleness toward the prospect of oral abilities. Open up and say, ah, Thomasima kept commanding all night long, and the tongues unfurled for display. Some had yellow spots or irritated taste buds. Others were blue with spoiled beef. Some performed lewd acrobatics, flicking up and down or curling upward to reveal spikes, depending from their undersides, like the armour of deep-sea fish. And then there were two or three that looked perfect, opalescent as oysters and enticingly plump. These were the tongues of the married men who'd already donated their semen in abundance to the lucky women taxing the sofa cushions across the room.
That's the enjoyment you were talking about, the enjoyment of writing.
Yeah, so although it is, as I say, I suppose what it sums up to, I mean, I'll be honest, I think this is kind of him marking time between, you know, he's written three, I think, pretty strong novels, one of which obviously Middlesex won the Pulitzer, and I suspect he's kind of marking time before he comes up with his next novel. But in the meantime, I think he's a really interesting writer. You know, as I say, it's almost against your better judgment. You don't like many of the characters that he writes about, but he writes about them with, as I say, with a kind of a precision and a wit which is kind of compelling.
We obviously know that he's written many novels, and people will probably know him best for his novels. But does he make a good short story writer? I mean, what does the medium of short story allow him to do that he wouldn't be able to do perhaps in a novel?
He's only written three novels, so he's kind of not very productive in the sort of, you know, in the Updike kind of universe, let's say, or even in the Bellow or Roth universe. But what he does in the short stories, but he's very good at denouement. He's very good at the... I mean, I think all of the stories I've mentioned, without giving away sort of spoilers, have great endings. So technically, in that sort of, I don't know, that kind of style of short story that maybe goes back to Saki, you know, here's a group of characters, you know you're going to be hanging out with them for not that long, but here's a little set of things that are going to happen, and I'm going to keep you hooked right to the end, and then I'm going to pull the rug from under you. He does that very well. Mm-hmm. One of the characters in Mitchell Grammaticus, who's one of the characters who appears in Middlesex, is in this book, and he has another really good story. He ends up He's gone to the Far East on a tour, and he ends up with dysentery. And he's writing to his parents instead of Skyping and FaceTiming them. He's writing to them, and he's literally dissolving. The book ends with him dissolving into the Indian Ocean. Brilliant bit of writing. But as I say, there's always a darkness and a needle in his stuff that keeps you alert.
Fresh Complaint is out now, published by Fourth Estate.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
The Monocle Weekly. Our original Sunday show brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
Now, the 1973 William Friedkin film The Exorcist is considered a masterpiece of the horror genre and is one of the most successful films ever. So how difficult must it be to adapt the story for a stage production? Well, director Sean Mathias has taken on the challenge and his production is about to open at the Phoenix Theatre in the West End. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the director to find out how you even begin adapting such a famous film.
It is quite a challenge, yes. I mean, when I first met the author, I was meeting him about doing another play of his. At the end of the meeting, I said, what else have you been doing lately? He said, The Exorcist. I said, wow. I said, I'll come and see that. And then the next day, I got offered it. John Pielemeyer has done a really terrific script. It's really an adaptation of the novel, but condensed into 9,500 minutes. And, of course, there are certain things in it that you will recognise from the movie, but it's very much the story of the book. And when I read it, it's just an absolute page-turner. It works as a very strong psychological thriller. So, yes, and I thought, well, you've got to be a little bit crazy to want to do this on stage, but it was such a great challenge that I took it on.
Yeah, because there's some, of course, classic scenes. I haven't read the novel, but I've seen the film. There's some crazy scenes, you know, when she was possessed by the devil. I wonder, did you have to use some special effects on stage?
What was your trick
to do those scenes?
Well, I'd like to think that I do the whole thing as a play, as a real play, as a serious play with proper characters and characterizations, and it's very, very psychological. But in terms of theatrical production, yes, as we use video, we use illusions, we've got a very, very strong soundtrack. Obviously, lighting, set, all those elements are very, very important. But it's as big in terms of production as doing a musical. So there's this quite small, intense, concentrated psychological play with just 8 or 9 actors. And then there's this very big theatrical production around it. And the thing that was most terrifying was the exorcism itself, because then she's fully possessed. There's 2 priests. There's Latin. There are certain things that, you know, her head turns, the bed rises, she levitates, there's projectile vomit, there's blood. There was everything in the original script. There's blood, vomit, and excrement. And I said, I'm not doing the excrement.
Yeah, that's
that's enough. That's enough now. It's quite an intense ride doing it, and it was a very, very big challenge, and I was totally terrified of the exorcism, but actually you just do it as it's written and it doesn't take care of itself. It's hard work, but the staging follows the writing. We perform an exorcism as such.
You have a fantastic career in theatre. Have you ever done something similar with horror or psychological thriller?
Nothing.
What do you want to say?
Nothing. I don't feel I've ever done anything that qualifies me to do this. And in some ways I said, well, I shouldn't be the person to do this because I know nothing of horror. I'm not a horror fan. I had seen the film of The Exorcist when it first came out when I was young, many years ago, and found it absolutely riveting and extraordinary. I mean, we hadn't seen anything like that before. But I haven't revisited the film, because I'm doing this version that's come from the book, and I don't want the film to get in the way or inhibit me, as it were, So no, I've never done it. I mean, I've done a lot of psychological work mm-hmm. and some very abstract work. But no, I've never done anything that relies on this kind of terror, horror and terror. But also it's very much a story of the abuse of a child. So it's very much dealing with protecting a child. So it's a very humane story, but it's very extreme.
The play was, in, I believe, in Birmingham.
That's right. We did it out in Birmingham Rep exactly a year ago. Yeah.
Are there any changes for this new version
yes,
at the West End?
There are. There's quite a bit. There's quite a few revisions to the script. There's one new cast member because sadly one of the actors couldn't be with us. But the rest of the cast is the original cast, which is exciting. There's a new video designer and a new lighting designer. So there's a number of changes. And the set is undergoing quite a few changes. But I think that there'll all be improvements. We learnt a lot from doing it before. And there were certain things I wanted to improve upon. So, and we only did 20 performances of it. So in those 20 performances, we learnt what works, what doesn't work. And now we're fixing those things.
And in London, for how long will it be on theatres?
It's on until, I'm not sure what the date is in March. It's on until about middle of March, yeah.
Okay. And tell us a bit more about the cast. You know, we have Adam Garcia as the father, Damien. For example, who is playing Regan?
Regan is a lovely, amazing actress called Claire Louise Connolly. I auditioned the Regans. I met about 100 Regans. It was terrifying. I met 100.
100?
Yeah,
wow.
Almost. I mean, a vast number of Regans came to see me over a period of some weeks. And then we whittled that down to a shortlist and another shortlist. And Claire Louise got it. And she's absolutely extraordinary. She was in War Horse for a year. She's a very fine actress. And she's very, very adept. She's got an amazing technique because she has to work with the illusionist. She has to work within the confines of the video, very big soundtracks. The demon speaks through her body. Mm-hmm. So she has to have the demon come out of her mouth, as it were. So she works very, very, very hard all night long. But she's completely, I mean, absolutely devastating to watch. She's extraordinary. And of course, she's not 12 years old, but I don't know how old she is and I don't want to know. Someone said to me one day in rehearsal, they said, you know Claire's 34. I said, shut up. I don't want to know. Go away. And she's not 34. She's absolutely not 34. But she's certainly not 12. She's a wonderful actress.
Mom? I am not a crazy person.
Well, I'm not saying you're crazy.
There is something inside my house. It's a demon.
A demon?
And it's trying to take my daughter.
Shin, I just want to ask you, what do you think is the appeal of The Exorcist? Because, okay, we're talking about the novel, the film. I think there's also a TV series coming out.
I don't know much about it. It came out when we were doing it in Birmingham. It's really good as well. I mean, I just saw one or two episodes, but it was really good. I don't know if it's Exorcist. Is it strictly horror? Is it strictly horror genre? I'm not sure. But horror has certainly grown and grown, hasn't it? The appeal of horror has grown and the audience has grown. I think the idea of doing these kind of very difficult subjects on stage is very appealing. There have been very few. There's The Woman in Black, which is still running, which is a thriller with spooks and frights. There was Ghost Stories. But there have been very few stories on stage where horror and horrific things happening and terror takes place in front of your eyes. I mean, we've now got a great magic show in Harry Potter, wizards and all that sort of thing, and that's got some spooks, but that's basically for children. And of course it's very beautiful and finely lovely, although it's got some scary things in it too. This, I think the audiences want to see these things done on stage and not done in a technological way necessarily, because you can see that on film. Theatre can't rival film in that sense. On film they can do absolutely everything now. But on stage, we can do things theatrically with a theatrical magic, with a different element, a different dimension. So I think there's an excitement about seeing something live. When we did it in Birmingham, the audience was very, very buzzed up to it. They were just waiting to be scared and waiting to be challenged. And they came and they started screaming from the beginning. And it was a lot of fun as well.
I'm sure it'll be a success in London as well. Thank you so much.
So. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
That was Sean Mathias speaking to Fernando there. The Exorcist will be showing at the Phoenix Theatre from the 20th of October till the 10th of March next year. Now, now, as always, we're ending the show with the Global Countdown with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, where are you taking us this week?
Well, we're taking us to Switzerland. And you know why? Because I believe, you've been working on the new issue, Matt. I think next week there'll be a Swiss special in Monaco magazine. So I said, let's find out what the Swiss are hearing, actually.
It's a very good idea. Yeah, as you say, next week we're on newsstands with the Swiss special. Yeah,
exactly. And I have a little surprise. Sorry, I didn't tell you this before we went on air, Matt. But before we talk about the top five, I want to show you one of my favorite Swiss singles of all time. And I think we have a clip of it, which we're going to play it now.
Chihuahua. 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 Chihuahua.
Amazing.
A very good track by DJ Bobo, one of my favorite Swiss artists. He's got other amazing singles like Vampires Are Alive, Everybody. The list is long.
Fantastic.
And Chihuahua was translated in so many languages. We even had a Portuguese version of it. Oh, wow. So just to mark a little bit, but shall we go to the real top five then?
Absolutely. So this week's top five from the year. Yeah.
It's quite a, very international. We have people from many countries, including Switzerland itself. Let's start with number five. We have the Swedish DJs, Axwell and Ingrosso, with More Than You Know, which is a very summery song. You know, we're approaching winter, but we still have those kind of tracks in the charts. And those DJs, I mean, they earn so much. Because they play, I think if you want them to play in your club, I mean, you pay millions, So it's another, quite a good single, I have to say. And number four, the only Swiss artist on the top five, it's Nemo. He's a very young Swiss rapper, even though he plays the violin and he plays the piano as well. So it's quite a, I would say, soft rap, The song is called De, which is in German. And he's been doing very well. I think he got some prizes at the Swiss Music Awards. So it's nice to see him in the chart as well. Number three, you have Post Malone featuring 21 Savage, which the song is called Rockstar. Post Malone's quite interesting. I mean, he's a rapper, but he does have other influences, including country music, because, I think his dad was a big country music fan, so he tried to use some elements of that in his song. And, I mean, in the US, he's huge as well. I think it's his first single, I believe, as well. So it's quite interesting there. Number two, have Pink, What About Us? She was number one last week, but not anymore, because we have a clip for the number one song. Let's play it. Quite Chihuahua, but it's a good song nevertheless. I don't know what you guys think. It's Zayn, a former One Direction, which, by the way, is doing incredibly well as a solo artist. I mean, he had a number one in the US with Pillow Talk, one of his past singles, and this time he's doing a song with Sia, the Australian singer as well. And it's funny because Sia, she has partnerships with all sorts of musicians, so Sean Paul and Katy Perry, among others. The song's called Dusk Till Dawn. What did you guys think of it?
It seemed fine. It seems
exactly.
That's a very much as I'd expect a kind of Swiss number one to sound. I mean, sort of, tuneful.
Yeah. It's a fine song.
Well produced.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that's presumably going to do well across the board. Around the world, surely.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of. I always get disappointed because when I look at the charts, I was like, I hope Nemo was number one, but unfortunately,
I'm just always relieved when it's not Despacito. So.
Oh yeah. By the way, Despacito. It is over finally, hopefully.
Never to return.
Yeah.
But no, I like it. It's a good song. But can we infer then, do you think, that the Swiss are quite fond of rap? They've got two rap songs there. And
they are fond of rap, and even, to be honest, I was looking at the best-selling Swiss single of all time. And it's not exactly a rap, but there's some rap elements. It's DJ Ötzi with Einstein, As I said, don't worry, it's not a rap song, but there are elements of rap into it as well, and I quite like that track as well. So,
fantastic. Thanks very much, Faye, for your global countdown today. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, John Mitchinson and Matt Wolfe. This show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Holly Fisher, and I'm Matt Alagaya. To play us out, let's have some more of that number one track from Switzerland. This is Dusk Till Dawn. Thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.